welcome to the Aquariumax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 86, recorded November 1st, 2011.
Greetings, everyone.
Hello.
We've got quite the show lined up today.
Let's see, a little preview. We have a voice message from Randall about the behavior of his silver dollars and tiger barbs. And then Drake is wondering about human foods that are appropriate for fish. So we will be talking about that. Mick in Carnforth we're going to discuss his mollies and amphipod culture. And Brian in Idaho has let us know about a new aquarium-related publication that we were just taking a little look at and looks really cool. So let's get started with the voice message from Randall.
Hello, Russ and Kelly. This is Randall. My wife and I have a 25-gallon freshwater tank. We just purchased it. We had, before that, a 10-gallon tank. In that tank resided two silver dollars. One is probably about 4 inches long, 4 or 5 inches long. The other one about 3 inches long. And they were really, really active swimming around the tank. And even when we put the new fish into the large tank, they were swimming around. However, we just purchased 3 barbed tiger fish, I believe they're called. They're kind of small with the black stripes. I think they're tiger barbs. And we have a group of 3 of them, and they're swimming around all over the tank. But the silver dollars now are cowering behind some plants. What causes that behavior when you introduce new fish into a tank like that? 3 small fish. The 2 biggest ones who swam lively around the tank are now hiding behind some plants. Just like to hear a little bit about fish behavior when you introduce new species into a tank. All right, bye.
Well, Randall, first of all, thanks for calling and joining the show. Then also, it's a good thing that you moved the fish to a larger tank. That's great because silver dollars like a lot of room, so the larger the better, really. There could be a lot of things going on in this situation that leads to this behavior with your silver dollars. But let's look at some of the most likely scenarios. We need to bear in mind that a combination of these factors could be at work, and there could also be possibly other factors that are involved as well. First of all, stress from the move, just an adjustment to having been moved.
Just being in a new place.
Can be a factor. I don't think so, because you mentioned that they were comfortable in the tank by themselves for a while, so that's probably not so much of an issue. And adjustment to water conditions, such as pH, going from one tank to another, could also be a factor. But again, you mentioned that they were well adjusted for a week or two before being moved, or after being moved to this new tank.
But these are kind of general guidelines for just in general when people are wondering what their fish are doing. So
right. Then it could be cycling stress, basically ammonia and nitrites in the water that could build up, and this can be something that happens after the initial introduction. There aren't a whole lot of wastes in the water, but they build up over a period of time, so that could be an issue. And then finally, aggression on the part of the tiger barbs.
Is that what you think is most likely?
Well, I think so, because in some follow-up information that Randall provided, he indicated that the silver dollars had been in the tank, like I said, for a couple of weeks before the tiger barbs were added, and they seemed totally fine, comfortable in the tank. And he also indicated that the substrate from the long-established 10-gallon went into the larger tank without rinsing. So
cycling shouldn't be too big of an issue.
Cycling, yeah, may not be too big of an issue. It's very likely that a lot of beneficial bacteria were successfully transferred over to the new tank and are, you know, functioning to some degree. Maybe not perfectly, but well enough so that cycling stress is less likely of an issue. It's a great thing that they transferred the substrate to help preserve the bacteria, the beneficial ones. But it might not hurt just to do a test of ammonia and nitrite in the water.
See what the conditions are.
Right, some test strips or a test kit, preferably, you know, one with reagents in it that you add as liquids and so on. Just to see if there are detectable levels of ammonia and or nitrite. It wouldn't hurt. And if it is, if they do come out positive, then you know you have to address that issue for sure. And I would probably start by adding some AmQuil or Prime that are made specifically to reduce the toxicity of ammonia and nitrite. and probably a bacterial cycling product. Just follow the directions for either one or for both of them. And as far as the bacterial cycling product would go, I'm not going to suggest a specific brand necessarily, but one of the refrigerated ones with an expiration date tend to be more realistic and efficacious from what I've been able to tell. But let's focus more on the aggression on the part of the tiger barbs, really, because I do think that's the most likely scenario here. They do have a reputation for being fin nippers. Tiger barbs are just that way.
That's a funny phrase. Fin nipper, you fin nipper!
Well, they definitely are. They can be fin nippers. It's not an undeserved reputation, especially when tiger barbs are kept in groups of fewer than about five or six fish.
Now, why five or six tiger barbs or five or six fish in the tank altogether?
Good question. I should have clarified that. Five or six tiger barbs.
Now, why are they more aggressive when there's fewer of them? When there's more of them, do they just think it's just not worth the effort to assert their dominance, or what?
Sort of. They do establish a pecking order mm-hmm. in their school. And if there are just a few fish, what ends up happening is that one fish will direct a lot of aggression towards the remaining fish, and then, maybe the alpha fish mm-hmm. will direct a lot of aggression toward the beta and the subsequent fish, and then they will direct aggression towards each other. But there's not enough, it's not diffused enough across a whole lot of fish, and so they tend to take it out on whatever else is in the tank.
I see.
But if you have, six, eight, ten more tiger barbs, each one gets a little aggression from all the others, but not enough to cause a big problem, and they tend to focus more on their own school dynamics.
It's almost like our favorite word.
Which one?
Surface area.
Almost, but not quite. But it is
almost entirely unlike surface area.
Right. But it does tend to diffuse aggression, among a lot of fish. And so I would say that one possibility would be to, once you've established that your bacterial colonies are indeed functioning at full capacity, your tank is cycled, you could get several more tiger barbs. I mean, that tank has already got kind of a lot of bioload in it. You don't want to go too far. But if you got two or three more tiger barbs, that might help a lot. Or consider trading the tiger barbs in for a less aggressive schooling fish like zebra danios or white cloud mountain minnows or something. And either way, one idea is if you still have the 10-gallon tank, you could set that up as a quarantine tank, put the new additions in there. Of course, you'd have to cycle that tank too first.
Right.
But that could help prevent introducing disease, because right now, apparently, there are no diseases that have been introduced by the
new tiger barbs. Did he say how long they've had the tiger barbs?
A couple of weeks, I believe. I may be wrong on that, but anyway, I think that would help to add some more tiger barbs.
Okay.
And once again, the silver dollars could, even though they've been there for a while, they could grow in response to a little more room in the tank and the higher water quality, and you may eventually need to move them into a larger tank. Because ideally, I probably would like to keep silver dollars in a 55 or larger tank.
How tall do they get?
They get almost as round as they're tall, and it depends on the species. There are various species out there, but pretty much all of them reach 6 inches long and almost that tall. So
Wow. They're
pretty big fish. But, yeah, thanks for your call, and hopefully that helps give you some ideas on what you can do about that.
Thanks, Randall. Okay, we're going to move on to Andrika in Oregon. And she's wondering, excuse me, about the top 10 human foods to give fish and how that works with pesticides on the food.
Okay, I thought this was a great question as well. So, Andrika,
Before we do this one, did we get her other top 10 done yet?
We're not done with that yet.
We're not done with that.
We'll work on it.
The verdict is still out on which ones we quote the most.
It's hard to figure that out. But we're still thinking about it.
Make you a top 50 list.
maybe we'll have to do that. But in the meantime, we can get to this one, so that's all right. I think this is a great question, the top 10 human foods to give to fish. And number one, these aren't necessarily in any particular order, although the first few in the list are more common in my book. Shelled frozen peas, number one.
Those are great.
Yes, so as long as you pop the little skins off the peas.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about the actual pod. The pod has already been removed. But the actual little skins on the frozen peas, if you pop those off, lots of fish will eat them.
And he means, like, you hold a frozen pea in your fingers, it thaws a little bit, and you kind of squeeze it down towards the water, and the actual
flesh of the pea
pops out of the little skin, and they can eat that. They can't eat it with the skin on.
Most fish can't get through that skin very easily. So you can use that for so many different fish, everything from guppies to bristlenose plecos to goldfish to whatever
anything
else. Coolie loaches nibble on
really.
Them. Yeah, just about any fish will like it. Betas like them. You know? So betas tend to be carnivorous, but they'll eat bits of peas. There's so many fish will like those. They help keep the fish's digestive system running because there's some roughage, some fiber in there. It's good for them. Number two?
Split green beans. And these can be canned or frozen. And I have to tell you a thing about the split green beans. Okay. What was it? Probably like 2 years ago. She was probably like 3 years old. Our now 5 year old wanted to feed the fish some green beans. And I, in my then ignorance, was about to just plop them in the tank because she couldn't reach. And she says, "No, Mama! You have to split them open first!" So she's this little kid and she knew how to feed the green beans to the fish. And it was just pretty cool. It made me laugh.
Yeah, because she had fed many a green bean to the fish with me.
Yes.
And so that's how she learned that. It's best to split the green beans along the natural seam there because the fish can't really get them open. Yeah, the fish can't get to the flesh as easily, most fish, unless you split it. And then if you don't, they can actually start rotting and polluting the water. But if you split them open, the fish can get to the inside and eat them. They're probably the favorite food of bristlenose plecostomus and cistrus species. They will go nuts over them. You drop them in the tank, and they instantly pop out from wherever they are, whatever recesses they're hiding in, and go after them like mad. They love those, and they're good for them. And they seem to prefer the canned over the frozen, amazingly, although they'll go for frozen, too. But they like the canned
ones. The
cans
are softer, probably.
They probably are softer. Okay, number three.
Zucchini slices.
Oh, yes. This is a big one at our house. Zucchini slices, once again, most fish that will even be interested in vegetation will go for zucchini slices.
Fairly thin slices.
Yes.
And not big, huge chunks.
We do tend to crush the slices between our fingers first so that the air bubbles are pressed out of them to some extent and they sink better. We use a lot of them from our garden.
And then we know exactly what's been on them, too.
Right. They're organic. If they're from our garden, and that has been very successful. And they are a good, nutritious addition to lots of fish's diets. Number four?
Kind of along that same lines, cucumbers.
Yep, they work essentially the same way as zucchini.
And you want the slices thin still, yes?
Yes, and the crushing also helps.
Thin, crushed things.
Now, number five?
Broccoli.
Yeah, I like to pinch off florets, either cooked or raw, for goldfish. They'll eat those. And I like to take the thick stems that most humans don't like to eat so much and cut them into little medallions, I guess you'd call them, and feed them to plecos and other herbivorous fish. They like those quite a bit. Number six?
Lettuce, as long as it's not iceberg.
Yeah, especially romaine lettuce. A goldfish can handle it without any sort of treatment at all. Some of the other fish like it better if it's been frozen or blanched or something like that.
Does that make it easier to rip apart?
Easier to rip apart and digest, yeah.
Okay. Number seven?
Oranges. Now, all the other ones you can give in fairly large quantities, but I wouldn't give oranges in large quantities. But a thin slice with the flesh available is good for goldfish. They like that. Usually what I do, though, is just take out a few of the little bits of pulp that haven't been juiced and pop them into the tank, and the goldfish will eat those. I'll just put a few in occasionally, not very much.
And not too many just because of the acid or too much sugars?
It could be that. The sugars, fish aren't really equipped to handle a whole lot of sugars and stuff. Okay. So I go really lightly on the fruit. I'll feed the veggies much more heavily. And we'll have to go to the next three right after our break.
This isn't a commercial, because it's not trying to sell you anything. It is, however, the part where we shamelessly encourage you to be a part of the Aquarimax audio show by calling and leaving a message any time of the day or night at 801-477-0629. If you don't want to actually talk, but you do have a comment or question, you can just send us an email to info@aquarimax.com. There. That wasn't so painful now, was it?
All right, we're back, and we're going to talk about the last three items on the top 10 human foods to give to fish. And number eight is...
Bananas.
Yeah. Now, once again, bananas being fruit, we don't give them a whole lot. But little bits of bananas are okay, very small. We started doing it with clown loaches. Clown loaches love bananas. But we found that several other barber fish like them, so occasionally we give them a little bit of banana. The goldfish, I like to give the little strings on the inside of the peel. They'll eat those.
Yeah, they like those.
Yes, things like that, but not in large quantities, once again. Now, with all of these veggies, we've mentioned it in passing, but either freezing, blanching, attaching them to something, or crushing them is usually best so that they will sink to the bottom and the fish can eat them. If they just float at the top, a lot of these fish are not terribly interested.
Especially plecos and things
Yeah,
like
goldfish,
that.
And some will eat them at the surface, but others really prefer it at the bottom. So those are good ways to provide them. And the pesticide issue, we do end up buying a lot of organic veggies ourselves. That probably helps. And it's very important to realize that many pesticides that aren't immediately life-threatening for humans can be very deadly to fish in small concentrations, even some of the plant-based ones, like the pyrethrins made from chrysanthemum. Mm. They are really bad for fish. So it's good to keep this in mind. Usually, if I'm using something like non-organic zucchini, I'll peel it before giving it to the fish, which I'm sure helps. But, yeah, we generally, most of our vegetables are organic anyway.
Just buy organic.
Yeah, it's
better for everybody. It's better for the earth. Mm. The only thing it's not better for is your wallet.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, we're on number 9.
Okay, yes, here we go. Hard-boiled egg yolk, or hard-boiled egg white, depending on the application. So I'm counting it as one, even though, because
hard-boiled
it's all
egg.
Eggs. Yes. Well, hard-boiled egg yolk, in very small amounts, is of interest to quite a few fish, especially small ones. A suspension of yolk made for fry, if you just get some egg yolk and put it in like a brine shrimp net,
mm-hmm.
and crush it and let it sort of leak through the net, you'll get a fine suspension of yolk particles, which is pretty good food for fry, especially if fed sparingly. It can foul the water very easily, so you have to be careful.
So you don't
want
to do too much.
But say you have a surprise spawn of egg layers,
mm-hmm.
and you want them to, in very small egg layers, not just like, not cichlids or something, but say white cloud mountain minnows or zebradaneos, and you need to get them some food really fast, and you don't have enough time to culture infusoria, something like that, then you can use this food until you get something else. And it works pretty well. I've used it quite a few times.
You've also used it for some things other than just the fish, triops and shrimp,
yeah.
things like that.
Yeah, shrimp like, red cherry shrimp like a little egg yolk. You just have to be careful because it will foul the water if not fed sparingly. Okay, and then hard-boiled egg white I've actually used as a food for triops, for ancestress fry, give them a little extra protein, something to vary the diet from algae chips and green beans and peas and zucchini and mm-hmm. cucumber. I give them a little hard-boiled egg white, and they'll chew on that until it's gone. So that can be useful food. And little bits are fine for goldfish and things like that, too. And then number 10.
Minced table shrimp or other seafood.
Yeah, as long as it's not too oily. There are quite a few different seafood items that you can use. And I think minced table shrimp is the one I've used most commonly. Yeah, that's all.
Just chop it up into little bits.
Yep. Don't give them too much. And those would be the top 10 that I use. And there are plenty of others that people use, but there you go.
I think that was a very good question.
Our top 10 list. I do mm-hmm. like that question a lot. Thank you, Andreika, for that question.
Andreika comes up with good questions.
She does.
We like her very much.
Yep.
Okay, we are going to move on to Mick now from Carnforth.
Okay, well, he says that in an effort to expand the spectrum of topics, he's going to slip a shrimpy one in under the guise of live foods. And it's not really about shrimp, per se. He starts out with saying his green copper mollies, so maybe that helps you with the color idea. You were wondering about Molly colors. Sailfin Molly colors last week.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He said they came in with really good quality and condition, and when they're settled in, he'll send some pictures.
Good.
That sounds good. He said with the shipment, he also received a starter color of Hialella Azteca, or Mexican Gammarus. Now, we usually refer to these as amphipods because the group is amphipods.
Mm-hmm.
Like the particular group of crustaceans. And this is a specific, you know, species name. The term gammarus is a genus name that refers to several different species, but it's also used as a common name.
Okay.
But I use amphipods usually, but it's the same general idea. And he says this is new to him. He's never cultured it before, so he was wondering if we had any experience culturing it at home or gathering it in the wild. He's starting it off in a 10-liter tank with a fine layer of crushed coral, some beech leaf litter.
And that's beech,
beech tree.
C-H, not leaf litter from the beach by the sea.
Right. And his all-around favorite, Nutella, which is a plant. Nutella is a different thing. It's a brand
it's good
name.
On sandwiches.
We can't even talk about it.
Sorry.
Because it's a brand name.
Forget
that's
I
okay.
Said that.
That's okay. And he said he's been researching it on the web, and people often use filter sponges as a habitat. Yep, surface area. That's why.
Surface area.
A lot of surface area. But I'm hoping to do it in a more naturalistic setup. I believe it can multiply really fast when established. That is indeed true. And we have cultured either Hialella Azteca or a close relative thereof that looks the same. And we did a dedicated podcast on culturing them back in 2009, so if you can bear to listen to us from back then.
Those ones are boring.
It's episode 6, and it's available on our website. Well, this one has some good information in it, though.
Okay.
And it's episode 6, so you can go back and check that out if you'd like to. And I don't recall if I mentioned that in that episode. If I used to collect them, because I did, I would collect amphipods that may have been a gammarus species, I'm not sure, in a stream that was not far from my house. And I probably wouldn't do so anymore because of contaminants and pesticides and hitchhikers and so on. But they existed in great numbers in this stream. Like, they were amazing, all over the place. In the stream bed, in the plants. So I'd scoop up some plants and just, there were amphipods. I'd shake the amphipods out of the plants. And they were big ones. They were, some of them, almost an inch long.
Wow.
And I fed them from everything from betas to salamander larvae. Not the inch ones to this, to the betas, but the smaller ones to the betas. And salamander larvae loved the big ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a lot of success with that. But the other ones, the smaller ones, I've had on various occasions, but the latest iteration of them came from plants we bought in Hawaii when we lived there. And Mick, your setup sounds like a great habitat for them. They do make a great food, and they may eat some of your Nutella, but Nutella's pretty good at growing. It'll grow pretty fast, so it'll be an interesting outcome. I don't know if the amphipods will completely win and eat every last vestige of the Nutella, in which case you'll just have to throw some in from another tank.
Depends on if you've got anything eating the amphipods, I guess.
Well, that's what I mean, but in his culture container.
Oh,
Nutella
yeah.
does grow fast, but so do amphipods. They're very prolific once they get going. One word to the wise, I would just say, be careful not to let them contaminate your shrimp-only tanks, because they really thrive in the same habitats that shrimp do. And they will eat plants, especially soft ones like mosses, but even tough ones like Java fern. They will go after those, it's particularly the new growth on Java fern. So in tanks with fish that prey on the amphipods, they're kept reined in by predation, but if you have a shrimp-only tank, they can just go nuts. Population explosion. And the problem is, you know, you can limit them by the amount of food they get, but if they eat plants and you're trying to grow plants,
that's a little tricky.
You've got an issue. So I introduced a honey gourami not too long ago to a 10-gallon shrimp and celestial pearl danio tank where the Java ferns were starting to look pretty ratty because the amphipods were just running rampant, nothing to eat them. The celestial pearl danios were too small to make a dent in their population. They may have picked off the odd juvenile, but not enough to do a whole lot. But this honey gourami took care of the problem. And the shrimp, the cherry shrimp, are still breeding in there, but of course the population is smaller because he picks off a number of those as well. I had a similar situation in a 5-gallon at work, my office tank. Once my betta got too old to hunt down the amphipods, they started reproducing like crazy. So I put in the African dwarf frogs. I think I've mentioned this.
Oh, they were quick.
And, yeah, they really handled them, made short work of them. And the plants began to thrive again. And I'm sure they're still in there in small numbers, reproducing. If I were to take the frogs out, they'd start reproducing again. But they're in small enough numbers that it doesn't damage the plants, and they're thriving again.
And the frogs get a snack sometimes.
Yeah, once in a while the frogs get a snack. And as far as contaminating your tank, that can be as easy as putting a sprig of Nitella from your amphipod tank into the shrimp tank, even if you don't see any amphipods on it. Like I said, I had some in Hawaii, and they showed up in some plants that I bought in Hawaii. When I shipped the plants from Hawaii to the mainland when we moved, I was required to have the plants inspected by the Hawaii Department of Agriculture, and one of the stipulations for export is that there can be no visible pests on the plants. So the inspectors, who knew us pretty well by then...
Sold plants.
Yeah, really. We sold plants regularly in Hawaii. They went over the plants pretty carefully, but within a few weeks, amphipods began to show up from the plants. And I'm sure there were some very small juveniles or something in
so
the plants.
So it's easy to not know that they're there.
Right. So that's just one pointer that I'd say just be careful with that. And then, but it sounds like your culture will probably thrive. And Mick also adds that he has some ideas on brackish water, but he'll see if he can call them in when he doesn't have his daughter sitting on his lap trying to press more keys than he is while he's typing.
I know what that's like.
Yes, we do. And he's going to send some of his...
Save those emails. They'll make you laugh in another half a dozen years.
Yeah. And then he said he's going to send some pictures of some snowball / pearl shrimp when he's got them in their new setup. So that sounds
cool.
All right, and then we've got
one more. Yeah. Oh, from Brian in Idaho. Oh, yeah. Yes, this is pretty neat.
Go ahead.
Oh, well, he just gave us a tip about a new magazine that's going to be coming out. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about what he said?
Okay, he said that he subscribes to Coral Magazine online, and they're going to be publishing a freshwater magazine as well, which apparently has been going on in Germany for some time, this publication of this freshwater magazine. And he was given a link to the preview edition and wanted to share it with us. And the link did work. Thanks, Brian.
Did we put it on the resources?
We will put it on the resources page. It's pretty cool. It looks like a fun magazine.
Pages.
Yeah, long magazine.
Like a book magazine.
Yeah, it looks like it'll be a lot of fun. It's got some pretty good in-depth articles on all sorts of things. We were looking at that article on the Plecos.
They had a green one with yellow spots.
Yeah, they had all kinds of them. And they were showing different species and how they bred and how some of them were really prolific and others not, and all kinds of things. And it looks like it'll be a fun magazine for, you know, any aquarist, basically, because it's got some advanced topics in there, but it's got some, you know, it's got a variety of different things, from that article on the stem plants to the Plecos, just different things. So thanks for sending that, Brian, and I hope you all have fun perusing it. I think the German name is Amazonas.
So are they keeping that name?
And I'm not sure.
In the English version?
I'm not certain if they're going to keep that name in English or not. They might as well.
Trying to determine if, you know, the articles are written in German and then they just translate it for the English version, or if there's, you know, a different English language version that is going to be printed. We weren't sure. But
either way, it looks fun.
Yeah. So. Looks like it has really good stuff in it, so...
Exactly. So, give it a look. Check that link out.
The resource pages.
Yes, and thank you to all of our contributors for today.
Very good questions.
We did indeed. And we welcome more of them, as always. So,
may the fish be with you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.